Yeah, okay.
This is 106 to 112. And so the road doesn't exist. There is 10 feet that makes that road very difficult to build with wetland buffers in place. So the proposal is to remove that plain road from the
boundary. Oh, so you're removing it. Okay. Great, thank you.
Right. Any member announcements?
Well, yeah. Actually, I was getting announcements. No, I apologize for missing last month. I was busy working on 179th stuff, but during the preceding month we got some really good news from the county and development community's perspective from Division 2 Court of Appeals, declaring that the items still out there that caused the county's invalidity under the GMA were moot, in fact. Which hopefully will enable the county to get out of the invalidity once that stuff procedurally goes back to the growth board, and should enable them again to start being able to seek public works trust fund loans as well as other grant opportunities. So it's a pretty significant win, I thought, all around.
Yeah. Anything else? Shoreline Master Program, period review.
Today I'm going to talk about the Shoreline Master Program periodic review, the project we are just getting started. So this is the first time I'm coming to talk to you, but I'll be back later. So I'm just going to do a quick refresher on the Shoreline Management Act, then talk about what this project is, talk a bit about the timeline, and then answer questions. So, Shoreline Management Act, it was passed by the legislature in 1971, and the intent of the act is to prevent the inherent harm in an uncoordinated and piecemeal development of the state's shoreline. And so in the act, there's an overarching framework of the goals and policies on how to do this, as well as sort of sets up the process for how to permit development along shoreline. And we implement the Shoreline Management Act through our Shoreline Master Program. So we develop and adopt it locally, and then the State Department of Ecology also has to approve it and adopt it as well. Three of the main policy goals of the Act are, one is to foster reasonable and appropriate uses, two is to protect natural resources, and three is to promote public action. So, when we actually think about what is the Shoreline Master Program, it's basically a long-range plan, and there are both policies in it, those are our comprehensive plan, and then there's a whole set of regulations on governing shoreline uses, and what you can do where, and how far back from water, and so forth. And those live in Chapter 40.460 in our development code. And then we also have a map that shows where the program applies. In the county, we have over 300 miles of shoreline that fall under the Shoreline Management Act, and two of our rivers are of statewide significance, so those are the Columbia and the Lewis Rivers. And then the other bodies of water that got pulled in are any stream segments that have a mean annual flow of 20 cubic feet per second or more. So, you know, that's from Salmon Creek to the Washougal River to Burnt Ridge Creek. So most of the creeks or streams you can think of probably fall into this category. And then it also includes lakes that are greater than 20 acres. So Vancouver Lake, Lake Norman, Dell Lake. So that's kind of the big view, but if we zoom in and actually think about what is a shoreline, it's defined as water bodies and the associated shorelands. And those shorelines include lands that extend 200 feet in all directions on a horizontal plane from the ordinary high water mark. It includes floodways and contiguous floodplain areas, landward 200 feet from such floodways, the full extent of floodplain, and all wetland and river deltas associated with the streams and lakes in the program. So this is what we're talking about when we're talking about shoreline jurisdiction.
When we reviewed this in the past, wasn't the floodplain was an optional add by the state regulations? So it required the 200 feet, and then the floodplain was where the local jurisdictions had discretion.
Right, so the only thing that the local jurisdictions have sort of flexibility on is if it's part of the floodplain or the whole floodplain. My understanding is Clark County has included the whole floodplain for a very long time. That's what our code says.
Most of the codes, except for Vancouver's, do the 100-year. Vancouver's carved out a chunk of the waterfront that they've gone at the least amount.
And I think what they're thinking about doing is doing away with the extent of the 100-year floodplain because there's no additional regulation to it. You still have to follow all the floodplain regulations anyway. So why make it part of that?
So you have to get a shoreline permit if you're working in that area.
But everything that you're doing to address that would be part of your floodplain permit.
Anyway. Right.
So they're thinking about there's a push in the city to remove that.
Jana, could you draw a distinction for me between the floodway and the floodplain?
Sure. This will not be an exact definition, but a floodway is an area that floods quite frequently, whereas when we're talking about the floodplain, we're talking about the 100-year floodplain. So floods less frequently than a floodway.
Okay.
Yeah.
Typically, it's in the Columbia River, it's the channel is a floodway. It's the water, it's the actual water surface, whereas the floodplain is developable under provisions under FEMA and city permit review processes. That doesn't probably completely help, but it gives a little more time.
It helps a little bit.
Is there another question? One other aspect of the Shoreline Management Act, even though it's been around since the 70s, it is connected to the Growth Management Act. Shoreline Management is the 14th goal of the Growth Management Act. And this shows up in terms of critical areas and how those are managed. So any critical areas, so wetlands, habitat, critical aquifer recharge area, so forth, if those are within shoreline jurisdiction, our shoreline master program is what regulates them. If those are outside, it's our critical areas ordinances that regulate those critical areas. And the main piece of that is we need to make sure our shoreline regulations protect those critical areas at least as well as our regulations outside of the shoreline. All right, so that's enough background. So what is this periodic review that we're doing? So the county did a comprehensive update to its shoreline master program. It finished that in 2012. And we've done a handful of just annual code amendments to update it since then. But this periodic review, it's mandated by the Shoreline Management Act. And it says that we need to review our S&P every 8 years and revise it if necessary. And the three things we need to do is to make sure it's currently changed in laws and rules, that it's consistent with other Clark County plans and regulations, and that it's responsive to changed circumstances, new information, and improved data. So this is not as big a project as what happened with that 2012 update. This is more along the lines of make sure it's current, you're totally up to date, so that it doesn't fall behind like many of the plans have previously. So earlier this week, the County Council adopted the public participation plan for this project, and that sort of outlines our work program, our schedule, and what we're going to do regarding public participation. So there will be a series of open houses. We're talking to advisory boards such as yourselves. We are going to be available to meet with neighborhood associations and any other interest groups that may want to talk about shorelines with us. And you know, then there's a more formal process that follows. There's going to be a 30-day comment period that we're doing joint with the Department of Ecology, and then there'll be our planning commission and council hearings. And in terms of timing, we are basically done with box one and are just starting into box two here, where we're starting to let people know, hey, we're starting this project. Here's the timeline. These are, you know, the time when you could weigh in. And we are going to do our first open house at the end of the month. And again, it's really more informational more than anything, and also getting any, if anyone has anything they really want to share with us around Shoreline that we should know, as we go into this project, you know, that's the time, now is the time to share it with us. And then once we actually have drafts, proposed, you know, possible changes that we may make, then we'll come back out, we'll revisit you to get the more specific feedback on what's being proposed. And then we're hoping to do most of that work through the end of this year, and then next year we'll move into the formal adoption process and hearings and so forth. So that's all I have, and I'm available to answer any questions.
Do you expect any big changes?
We have a short list of, they're not very big. It's more similar to what we've been doing every couple of years. We're in decent shape in terms of being up to date with laws and things like that. We are looking at a few sort of clarifications we need to make on the map, which would be something we haven't done since our last update. But we are not aware of any major changes as of right now.
Is this the time for individual property owners to look at revising their shoreline designation or somehow changing it to something different?
You know, I don't think we're really considering changing designation as part of this project. I mean, they match pretty well with existing zoning right now, and there was a lot of work that went into it. I think if someone did have a major concern, though, tied to it, I mean, it would be good for us to know. I'm not sure if we'll be able to address it or not.
Yeah. Does it keep up with like LOMARs, where they change the floodplain through map revisions?
Right. So our Level Shingle River flood maps were updated fairly recently. So we do need to make sure the map gets updated to reflect that. We have references in code, but we need to get the map current.
And then there's individual sites too, so looking at all that, that'd be a pretty big project. But the LOMARs, with the letter of map revisions that go through, then change like based on certain sites that were just approximate, and it changes them, then they might be out of the shoreline where they would be in the shoreline otherwise.
Yeah, so there is, there's one area east of Orchards, basically where we had, as development has happened there and staff has gone out to visit, we have realized there are several sites that aren't actually in shoreline even though they show up on the map. So that is something our wetlands biologists are looking at to see if we can, do we have the documentation to remove a chunk of, you know, the map, or will it have to be on a site-by-site basis. So that's something we're looking at, but I don't know what's going to happen with that.
Hey, one other quick question. So you mentioned before one of the goals is promoting access, but then one of the other ones is the shoreline regulations must protect at least as well as critical area regulations. Well, critical area regulations are almost it's like a do not touch. It's almost like a restraining order on the stream, so you can't go anywhere near them. You got to put a fence up. So it, by nature, doesn't promote access to the stream. So what do you do in those situations where those two goals conflict? Is there anything considered updating to allow going into the critical areas to promote access to meet the goal of the Shoreline Management Act, or to critical area regulations just supersede them?
I'll make note of that. I mean, it's something we can look at, but I do think there's code does get pretty specific into each of them. And I don't know, Gary, if you wanted to chime in. You look like you wanted to.
So our Shoreline Master Program includes all of the critical areas ordinances. So everything that's in the wetlands, the habitat, all the critical areas, it's included by reference. So any of those, so it's all taken in and it's looked at through the lens of the shoreline. So however that, so when it comes to like someone wants to have a private dock in the shoreline, well, sorry, you can't. You have to have other joint use access.
So it allows those. So the critical areas ordinances would allow an impact for a public use facility. Because I don't think they're written into. They're not necessarily, that's something that's unique to a shoreline that's not in the critical area ordinance.
Right. That's why, so those pieces are tied into the shoreline. So that's how they're joined together. So it's looked at through the shoreline.
So there's setbacks in shorelines, and then there's critical area criteria that have to be met. It's not a no touch, but I mean, you're correct in some aspects of that. That it's like a no touch, but it depends on the proximity. I think some of the shoreline buffers already kind of limit where you can go. If the question usually comes into within those areas that you're allowed to go up to, say it's 100 feet, there may be critical areas that you're impacting, even if you're going 101 feet from the ordinary high water mark. So it's kind of the functional, but there's mitigation allowances there, but I think those are already, like Gary's saying, it's already built kind of into the code. It is challenging what because you have to really justify that if you're going to get a variance. That's probably beyond this code update, which kind of asks the question, are the setbacks appropriate?
Yeah.
That's the
My thoughts are is some of our beautiful parks are right along the shoreline.
Yep.
And if you did them under today's code, they'd be almost impossible to build those same parks.
Salmon Creek Trail would be one. Yeah.
All of those areas, and they're great amenities to the community. Yeah. And the way the regulations have gone, I know this is a little bit beyond this, but just more of a thought, is that it'd be a shame to not be able to have those facilities and expand on those facilities because of the conflicts and the goals and the critical areas. So if you are doing it, something like a public facility, maybe even an exemption from critical areas for public facilities like that, that do promote access to the water body to meet that goal, would be exempted from critical areas and considered maybe self-mitigating or mitigate off-site. Because I know a lot of them, there's not really ways to mitigate down to zero buffer on the critical areas. You can work in some outside areas. So you couldn't access them under the critical areas ordinance. You need to put some kind of an overriding kind of a goal or a mitigation measure for those to create those types of facilities that really benefit them. So I guess I encourage you to look at that.
Yeah,
so if we have options for our parks and facilities like that.
Yeah, I think we can see. We'll double check with the state.
Yeah. What you're really, from a public access standpoint in a habitat area, you're limited to a 4-foot wide soft path, which does not necessarily equate into ADA accessibility. It doesn't equate into a variety of different uses that you could have along the shoreline. That's a good point.
Yeah, just something to look at.
Yeah.
Since you're looking at it.
And just
one other thing, although we're not technically, I'm not involved with this all that much, but just the exemption for single-family residential lots could probably be handled a little bit easier and correct, it's not something that our company really gets involved with, but it's a pretty strenuous process. It used to be back in the day it was exempt. People didn't even seek a permission. They said it's exempt, and now there's a process to get the exemption. And so it's just, it seems like there could be some parameters that are very specific about that exemption, like you meet this box and basically you're done, versus going through a little elaborate process for single-family homes, because they are technically exempt.
To go through the shoreline permit process to find out you're exempt.
Yeah. So maybe it's already
They whittled it down to where you don't have to now go through the entire shoreline process in order to get the exemption.
Yeah, yeah.
It's more of a fill out the form. Still, yeah. 3 or 4 pages of work.
I'm just saying, could there be improvement? I mean, it's improved, but yeah, I'm just...
Anyone else?
Two things. One, matter of process, I know last time there was coordination with all the other jurisdictions. Is that going to be happening?
We are not pursuing that. We don't have to redo any of the underlying data. So the last update, we did, that was super helpful for the coordination. But because it's really largely focused on updates to the code, and we haven't found a need as of right now as to do that.
No. Okay.
Yeah.
And then I think along, sort of piggybacking on what Don had mentioned, I know that there was I have to go back to my files, but I know when this was early on, new kind of sprang on a bunch of property owners, and they got into sort of weird code enforcement situations, and the code was so cumbersome to sort of work your way out of a problem that it might be more useful for the county to look at making that process also easier and less onerous.
Which process?
Like when you're having to go get a shoreline permit post code enforcement activity, I think it automatically drags you into like the most severe thing, even though the impact may have not been that great.
Some of the impact or not, how's it feeling when they were done? Years ago.
Pre-buyers. There's one instance I can think of, like for instance, where there were some deadfall trees and that were removed, and then there was an accusation about, you know, shoreline violations, and that sort of swings into having to do get environmental consultants on board and prepare massive mitigation plans on something that really shouldn't warrant that level of permit post-haste.
I think it happens more often than we think. People come in to do additions or whatever, someone goes out for a site visit. That's what happened to the guy in the bush over.
Yeah, he's right
now. And soaked a whole bunch of hot water.
Question.
Is this your fault?
Yes,
just about every third page in this one.
Your fault is so awesome.
Let me have a copy of this one.
How do you know you have the right one?
You just found out before you meet the target last week.
Just email him.
This is why he doesn't want me to do that before.
How come you didn't take a picture of you and put it on the front, on your bike?
Yeah, there you go.
It's a great question, right?
That is a great way to close someone out. Great question, Mike.
Gary Albright, Clark County Community Planning, is here to talk about the police chief's update. Here's the agenda, it's kind of a roadmap of what we'll discuss.
No pun intended.
A few minutes. Yes, no pun intended. Yeah. Good. Quick background about the police streets. The two key dates that occurred. In 2011, the legislator established the police streets grant program. In 2015, the legislator designated the Washington Transportation Improvement Board as the police streets grant agency that can award grants anywhere from $100,000 to $1 million. It's flexible money for police streets projects. You know, what are complete streets? These streets are transportation policies and standards that enable safe, convenient, and comfortable travel and access for all users of ages and abilities, regardless of their choice of transportation, whether through transit, driving, walking, or biking. So here's some past pictures of what we have done. These streets have been around for quite some time. Clark County has had particularly called them these streets. On the upper left corner of Northeast 10th Avenue, that is a collector, a two-lane collector with center turns and bike lanes. So that's what you're looking at in the background of Cripple Creek. That was just recently built. And this whole stretch has been approved almost down to 141st Street. So So it's currently in design right now from 149 to 154. So we'll have a whole stretch that anyone can park their bike, drive up to the park and ride on 139, get out and ride the bike up to the fairgrounds to see any kind of event at the amphitheater. That's a nice opportunity to have. And on the right is Northeast 15th Avenue. That is a two-lane minor collector with center turns and bike lanes. That one was built in 2007. Northeast 137th Avenue was built in 2001. We've also got other areas of Clark County that I didn't show you. Northeast 25th Avenue was built in 2002, but from 78th Street to 99th Street. Penn Parkway was done in 2003, two streets. And Northeast 119 has been done in 2014 and 15, and we're working on right now. And that's basically a street. With this Fleet Streets update, we've created a Fleet Streets guideline, basically for the Transportation Improvement Board. It's a document that describes the steps Clark County has taken, continues to take, and envisions for the multimodal transportation system. So this won't be part of our development code, but it will be included in the package for the ordinance at the end. So it gets sent up to TIP so they see it's all going to be piece.
And this is mainly for applying for and getting grants,
yes,
for improving existing streets to existing current standards to meet the goals of the mid streets.
Yes, it's the buzzword that TIB is looking for. So they have a list of things they're looking for: comprehensive policy, development codes, and some sort of other guiding documents to help the community realize that Clark County is serious about having these streets.
And these are arterials, Gary? Is that right there?
Arterials and collectors.
Okay.
These streets are not. They're not new to Clark County. Doesn't mean every street in Clark County will have a bike share.
That's not a mandate.
For immediate retrofit, it's not a silver bullet. Doesn't mean there's funding for everything in Clark County. Here's our Streets guidelines process. So we've got three steps basically. Step one is our comprehensive plan text and policies that we looked at last year and they were approved earlier this year. And step two is the Title 40 amendments, Chapter 4350, that are consistent with the comprehensive plan policies. And step three is adopting the ordinance and hearing on the fifth. Here's a refresher of the policies that were looked at last year and adopted this year. 5.12 and
5.2.3. And Gary, just a question. That's Hazel Builder, obviously. And there are street lights in that section. Is that something that the county's looking at doing, perhaps elsewhere, street lights outside of the urban core areas as part of complete streets?
So the county does not generate tax revenue associated with putting in street illumination. So the neighborhoods, typically even on sections of Highway 99 we care, they're actually the vast majority of the streetlights are paid for through roadway lighting improvement districts. We have approximately 300 luminaires that are owned by the county, paid for by the county, that are under contract with CPU, in addition to the traffic signals we have. So those are our river crossings and some very other specific locations, along with some really weird ones that are like on private roads and we have no reason to have, and we're working to transfer those over to the individuals because there's no reason why we pay for them. A light on a private road, but for some of the states on our road. We are looking at the fact that we have an urban area, but we're not required to put street lights in like a city would be. And so
in order for us to be able to develop a streetlight program, we would have to have some revenue source to be able to have that program to own, maintain, and operate them, or cut some of the service to be able to fund the streetlights. So one of the things that we're going to be taking on over the next year is taking a look at what the opportunities are, because there are safety benefits, there are pedestrian benefits, and wide range of benefits you have for them. But we're not really, because we're a county, we're not really funded to be able to provide those sources. So how do we move from ignoring it to acknowledging it and trying to find a way to actually put it in the center?
Good, okay.
So the grant program does not include money for lighting at all? So the grant program?
What grant program?
This grant.
It may. Okay. This is an interesting grant program where you are nominated for receiving a potential grant amount, and that grant amount you're nominated for could be between somewhere between $100,000 and $1 million.
Right.
But we have two aspects of whatever we do. One is the initial capital investment. The second one is the ongoing maintenance. And so we do not have the staff, we do not have the equipment, and to have the ongoing maintenance, we don't have the budget for the maintenance. So anything that we would be putting in, we'd have to be finding a way to do that ongoing maintenance. Clark Public Utilities has made it very clear that they do not want to inherit any more Clark County-owned, Clark Public Utility-maintained luminaires. So if we're going to put any luminaires in, we have to do it ourselves. And then you get into the vagaries of what you can do with what's called NEC lighting versus NESC lighting, and whether or not you have to have an electrician in order to work on it, or it's isolated so that you can have it worked on without having an electrician's license and a bunch of other things. You have to have a bucket truck, you have to have all the tools, you have to have specialized people working on it. So it isn't a simple thing for us to step into what we are looking at.
I hear you. I'm just wanted to ask the question generally. There are parts of Salmon Creek and Hazelville that could clearly use street lighting.
There are areas in the rural area that we would improve safety by putting street lights in where there's left turn pockets or sags in the road to be able to improve cyclists at night, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot more than just the urban area that we're looking at.
Gotcha. Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
Way more than one.
No, that's actually good.
It's always good to have
a lot of
information. We've had 40 minutes. So the 4350-00, the current classical and sidewalk standards, we're going to renumber them to 4350-020, so they're not going away. So this will be new to the code, so we're just renumbering this. And the purpose, so there's four pieces to the new 4350-00. The first one is the purpose, which encourages street and road designs that incorporate safe access to all users with the goals of promoting health, improving safety, protecting the environment, and preserving community character.
Can you state 010?
Yeah.
What's that?
Can we make it
010 somehow? Like, 010B or something, because then we have to change the concordance.
Oh, like, can we change the letter 010 and just keep everything the same? Yeah.
Then you're gonna have to change 020, 030, 040, and all the subsections. I mean, I don't know.
Add it in somehow.
Yeah. These guys use it quite a bit, and it is
references
in a lot of places.
Correct.
This is from like 6-7 years ago.
Yep. We looked into that.
Oh, okay.
Well, yep.
Yeah. I'm actually doing it right.
Yep.
But just the sense.
I'm trying to get it. A couple definitions. It's the second piece. Third piece is the design. So basically what we're saying with the design is that we're using our existing standards and practices. And then the fourth piece is the exceptions that are allowed by the county engineer.
So
So go back to that last slide here. So are these new? Are these proposed to be new?
Yes, they will be new to this code.
So how does this differ from, say, road modifications that we had applied for the same reasons? Because when we're developing, maybe this is from a county design and construction standpoint, insofar as getting funds for that through this, not from a private development that would need to follow the regular road standards anyway.
So the regular road standards will be followed, because that's what we're using right
as a basis.
As a basis, and these are the additional exceptions to those regular standards that will follow.
For county led improvements.
Yes, through the complete streets.
Okay.
Be identified.
Sorry, I had to work that out.
What he's asking, whether that's going to impact the developers or developments, whether we are going to be enforcing any part of it as part of our requirement or reviews.
I can't foresee that happening.
Okay. Is there any chance that these exceptions might confuse, say, someone like me who's reading it in the code, and it's like, oh, well, we've got this critical area over here, we can go ahead and get an exception. And then Bali's like, no, you need a road modification for that. And I'm just thinking, depending on, it's in 4350, we go there to find our road standards. If this section is in there, I just want it to be clear that this is only for those projects that are undertaken through the Complete Streets project program.
And that's true. So these exceptions will only apply to the Complete Streets.
Okay.
And that's clear, because one of the things on slide number 9, it said 5.2.13, design and construct complete streets wherever feasible and practical.
Okay.
So when I see that, it makes me think, okay, they're feasible and practical in neighborhood streets. However, applying to complete streets in those situations mean you no longer have parking on the streets. So I know there was a hearing on this a few years ago, and we looked at this once already. This isn't new, but there was some kind of work session or hearing on complete streets in the county. And I know the councilors were really concerned that, okay, it didn't take away parking, but it was only for basically county-led projects for grant money, things like that. I want to make sure that is the case.
It's not the intent to take away anything.
Okay.
All we're doing is verifying our existing practice.
And is it written that way? Because if it's not written that way, somebody else new could interpret it differently, and then all of a sudden the whole complete policy changes based on the code.
As long as there's something that defines it as an arterial or a collector, you're not talking about a street you're going to be allowed to park on anyways.
It doesn't say in this thing, design and construct complete streets for county-led projects on blah, 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 where feasible and practical.
Right.
It says wherever feasible and practical, which is the scary language.
And 4350.010 starts with applicability of section applies to any subdivision, short plot, site plan application, or conditional use permit. So that's why we want to make sure that somebody's not going to read that and go, oh, we get exceptions for when they may not recognize that this only applies to the complete street projects undertaken by the county.
And we have to make that very clear, because we struggled through the Highway 99 sub-area. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of requirements that appears to be in conflict with the district. As an example, when you require to do a 12-foot wide sidewalk, does a road not get rid of that, or vice versa? If there is something in 350, that's Highway 99 sub-area can override.
Right.
What is in 350? We are having a little bit of we have to clarify sometimes the differences and what is takes precedence. I think it's very good to do that here, since make it as clear as possible, so we don't have to,
But there may be other streets that apply, like if you're building a subdivision, and you're building a collector or an arterial as part of the subdivision, portions of the county project. Or there may be aspects that do apply to local access roads that are within the subdivision. So we can take a look at the wording on here.
I just want to make it clear. When I look at the applicability of 43010 right now, and it applies to private development, it leads me to believe that at some point in time down the road, that's going to cause some confusion.
Okay. Yeah, great.
So that's
mm-hmm. Thank you. What are we proposing for these streets that you're already doing?
No, that's not the point. Okay. That's not the point. If this is focused,
it's the exemptions piece of it.
It's the exemptions piece of it right here that might confuse people, and we already have a road modification process to address these very things here. Well, but we don't have exemptions.
One of the things that we need to be very careful of is the TIB is extremely prescriptive in what this must say. So we don't have a lot of latitude to change the code because the TIB wants very, very specific language that meets their criteria and has to be specifically approved by them for us to be able to apply to the grants.
Yeah.
So we don't have a lot of latitude to be able to change this route. But understanding the policy document of how we apply it may be more appropriate.
Right. Whatever works. Whatever clarifies it.
And whatever clarifies to make sure that this does not apply to private development.
Okay. Or that it does.
If it's a corridor, then we're doing it. Yeah, that's appropriate. But what it says, that the piece that says wherever possible, or what was that language again?
Practical,
practical and feasible. That basically would mean in most situations you're eliminating all parking spots and putting in bike lanes everywhere. And then it becomes more than what you need. There's certain corridors that I think you got to plan for everything. So I know it's not your intent, but the language alone could be misinterpreted without some additional document.
So the spirit of it is of big streets is to have mode choices.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not taking away anything. So that's the way all this is written. Is we're not taking away anything. But we'll definitely look at it to make sure it's clear.
Yeah.
Yep, perfect.
Perfect, thank you.
Yep. Thank you.
And the next steps. So we had a council work session last October. We had the Commission on Aging review complete streets update. They had offered some suggestions for clarity as well. So they've been looking at our transportation standards last year, and they made some recommendations that kind of build on that. So they just wanted to make sure that the complete streets don't preclude the ability to connect to a street from biking or walking. So that was their offer that they had. So I'm sharing that with you. And then the Bike and Pedestrian Advisory Committee saw it last week. They recommend having the complete streets update happen. And they suggested that public health could possibly write a letter of support, and contact public health. They wrote a letter of support for the complete streets update. And we have a planning commission work session this evening, and hearing on September 19th. We count the council work session on October 2nd, and hearing on November 5th. That's it.
Anything you need from us?
Well, last year you talked about supporting the complete streets update. You're welcome to that.
Well, I would move that we provide continued support for this complete streets program with the understanding that final code language makes it clear that any exemptions listed is specific towards the complete streets programs and does not apply to private development. Second.
Once again, come back to the TIB requires that they not have the latitude to do that.
Yeah. I think the most is just that we can provide continued support based on that and with some clarification. And it could be in a policy document, like you suggested. Like, that's a great idea. So if the code language isn't to change, we reference the policy document and when it applies. So I think that same conversation came up in the last adoption of it, when you first adopted it.
Okay.
So I remember the counselors, and you were probably there too. Yeah.
Are you clear on motion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstained?
Thanks, Gary.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Northeast 179th Street, Urban Holding Next Steps.
I'm going to share the stage with Jamie, since he can give it from the developer's perspective. So, the trigger's been pulled, so to speak. Next steps for us is to manage the developer agreements that have been built around this, and that has been the foundation for the reasonably funded aspect of this, where we have to get we have to convince the state to release the $50 million or so for the 179th Street improvements. This was an amazing amount of work, and especially by the developers and their teams. We couldn't have done it without them. This is sets a precedent in ways that have never been contemplated before, when you have to reach into your private industry to come forward with a really workable plan to help things move forward, because this would have been impossible for the county to take this on themselves. It just couldn't have been done. So it had to come with a lot of coordination and effort that has been ongoing for the better part of a decade, if not longer, and long before I arrived here. And it's amazing for me to see this level of commitment and moving forward, being able to work with those individuals who built this is going to be outstanding. Our team, Matt Herman, all of us, really laid a foundation that is going to be workable from the perspective of managing the developer agreements, ensuring compliance, ensuring that there's early notice for benchmarking, for compliance requirements, payments, right-of-way dedication, whatever the case may be. What we want to do is position ourselves for success. And so the next steps, and which I'm going to actually publish a kind of a summary that will help capture this. The next steps for us is to really take a hard look at each one of the agreements, make sure that we've got those in a spreadsheet that we can track all the, we identify all the stakeholders and all the decision-making along the way. Make sure we have staff resources in place to send those notices out as needed. Give early notice so there's nothing is missed, and all the critical points are hit along the way. So it's a well-organized workflow, both internally and for our external customers. One of the most important things about this entire process was the dialogue that was the foundation for all the decision makers. Anything that lasts this long, this kind of longevity, there's a lot of change in the players along the way. So there had to be a lot of backfilling, bringing people in that didn't have the, I'm one of the people that arrived very, very late in the game. And so I was totally reliant on all the people that had been there before me. I took the reins not knowing anything about it and was immediately educated, but wanted to make sure that we're successful in administering these agreements, but at the same time making sure that we don't miss opportunities for improvements, for enhancements, and have flexibility inside these agreements. This has been something struggled with in community development, is finding that flexibility and finding ways to ensure that we're not impeding development. You know, from my perspective, And from our team's perspective, anybody that walks in the door with a permit application should succeed. We don't want to disincentivize permit applicants. You know, we don't want to chase them away from the process with so much process that it doesn't make economic sense for them to do it. In this particular case, there's still a lot of work to be done in the land use application process, the right-of-way, traffic mitigation. The list is endless. But we have a team in place that is going to do the heavy lifting on our perspective, make sure that everything's organized. So as the permit applications come in, they're processed as quickly as possible. And we call out any sort of stakeholder issues are identified early in the process. And that's really where we need to come from right now. Ton of evaluation needs to be done. I'm going to hire some temporary help through the winter to help me set up the spreadsheets, set up the compliance requirements, and do the notifications and identify all the stakeholders and get to know folks. So, Jamie, from your perspective,
I want to again echo my public statements during the hearing and thank Matt and Oliver and Susan and Taylor and Chris and Sean Hennessy and Mitch, of course, and Ahmad. And then from the private side, Terry's one of the signatories, Mark Hinton, Lance Killian, and the whole team. As Mitch sort of alluded, it's a lot of us have been plugging away at this for the better part of a decade, and I think there's been some consistent players on the county side, but you know, certainly the development folks have been pretty consistent over those period of years, and it took a lot of patience and fortitude and a lot of negotiations to get us to the point where we were able to execute the development agreements. So I think as far as those four projects are going forward, I know they should be starting to submit at least pre-applications now. They're not allowed to go forward to public hearing until sometime in the spring next year, but the objective is to try to get some projects out there doing site work next year and hopefully start putting some houses on the ground in the fall of next year on some of these projects. And then for the rest of the urban holding area, what's sort of contemplated is when we get to the end of the year and the county councilors make a decision on the finance plan, which they sort of pre-blessed during the development hearings, they'll move then pretty swiftly forward with traffic impact fee updates to the CFPs and the TIP list, which should enable the release of the full urban holding area sometime in spring, I think ideally is what the plan is, which should open up thousands of acres for development, which is very exciting, and it really comes at a much needed time as all of us know that we're sort of running out of available dirt in our other communities that have it. So with that, I'm just questions. Thanks, Terry.
It's a long process. I will offer that one of the challenges we want to avoid is resourcing pinches along the way, and there's going to be a pretty heavy demand for site development, for building construction along the way, for the right-of-way work and everything else. So managing that means that we're mindful of our succession planning and ensuring that we have our most talented, most experienced people out there doing the work for you, so there's a higher probability of success, whether it's with an inspection or a stormwater review or whatever the case may be. We've got a way of moving resources around the county, which is pretty effective for area assignments and stuff, so we can put teams together. One of the things that I like about this particular location that it's centralized, and because of that centralization, we can utilize resourcing in that as a tool to identify and supplant things like multiple inspections by a single inspector over a short time frame, but having a cadre or a team that works continuously with the developer to ensure that there's a higher probability of consistency in our work on those sites, and building those really strong relationships so we can succeed early and not have to come back to the drawing board or repeat inspections or fail an inspection and have to come back and resource it a second or third time. There's a lot of opportunity here, and it will help make us better. So we're ready. All right.
Thank you. Thanks, Mitch.
Appreciate it.
One of the things with that I'll note is making sure everyone was aware of the updates in the school impact fees, and that made some changes in that corridor. So something to be cognizant of on the school impact fee updates. We now have two of the impact fees in this urban molding area are in the top five now in the state as far as cost. So it's good we're adding inventory. I don't want to put a wet blanket on it, but it is. There's also this. It's going to make it does make it difficult too to provide an affordable, attainable housing side because of those. Because we're pushing those limits on being like these. So how we overcome that, that's not an easy answer. Development agreement procedures.
So I'm trying to pull up the code right now, the draft code. Computer's a little slow. But this is a follow-up from last month where I presented draft development development agreement procedures to be with the expectation that you're coming back here in September and asking for your recommendation. Since my presentation in August, we had a planning commission hearing where they reviewed the draft code from the version that was given to you. They made a unanimous recommendation to the county council to approve that draft code with no changes. So, and as I mentioned in August, county council wanted both recommendations from DEEP and the planning commission to be separate, so that it's way for the people. So, with that, I'm open to any questions. I'll pop it up here on the screen soon.
So, just a clarification from our minutes. I think we were pretty supportive from what was presented last month.
Yeah.
We just had a few questions, right? So, let's see.
You might just want to have a touch on this.
That's what I was thinking, yeah. Development agreement procedure, PowerPoint presentation.
It didn't really get into what our concern was.
I think that the two issues are, well, there's the issue of one of them, Matt, was the time frame, because it was 10 years. And
that was one, yes.
So the length of the DA,
yep.
I think, is really critical in terms of having it to be at least, I mean, if there's a number in there, I think it should be at least 20 years. And that's typical what we see.
Possible instead of
or longer. Maybe it's negotiated, but it could be up to 20, but
right.
Right.
Because sometimes it takes 4 or 5 years just to get through design and you know, permitting on something that under construction
in the market.
Well, it would be a major recession.
Yeah, the market is a huge issue. Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. Like I mean, like what we just talked about, I mean, that everything's great now, but like. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, somebody that negotiates these, I think that, well, it's usually. We usually do 10. Yeah.
Nowadays. That's pretty standard.
But I think having the option to go beyond that, I you know, there's not a lot of case law on how far out these agreements can go. I know sort of at the outer end, there have been a couple that were 20-year agreements, and those were for projects that are usually like you're trying to protect some non-conforming right on a property that may sort of phase out, or if you have a really massive phase project,
yeah.
But that should really be at a negotiated term.
I think that there's some good examples of what you just mentioned, Jamie. Port of Vancouver, Centennial Industrial Park, it's not built out. That was a 20-year new development agreement. And it's still being built out. And the universities fall into that same category. They're never really done. So I think those are, you know, anything that's master plan could very well go more than 20 years.
So I think our recommendation was under applicability, under number five, it's a development agreement to terminate 10 years from the date of recordation or earlier, if specified in the terms of the agreement. Instead of or earlier, it said unless otherwise specified. So then it allows you to go longer or shorter.
Yeah, it can be either.
So, yeah, if 10 is the industry standard,
why change it? If Jamie, if you're comfortable with that,
yeah.
But yeah, making it so it can be longer, not just earlier.
You're just giving two
just make it some more flexibility.
Why we yep. have the opportunity or the given
yep.
option to go.
I mean, residential is different. I mean, I mean, that's my point. I mean, I think you'd be hard pressed to go beyond 10 years to develop a subdivision unless it was massive. I mean, it is different.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And maybe include ways to extend it. I mean, I think you always have that option. We've done that on several projects before. We've extended it.
I mean, I don't think 10 is enough. I mean, quite frankly, I mean, I for many projects. And let's say, for example, I know the industrial land bank kind of collapsed, but let's say that comes back in the county. I mean, mm-hmm. 10 years is nothing in the industry business.
Yeah.
You know, I mean.
Yeah. So just flexibility.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think just making that or unless otherwise specified.
What was the other point that we were...
Hey, now, did you have that?
Oh, I actually had a new one. That
okay.
Cool.
Okay. And then for existing development agreements, Matt, and this kind of gets back into the date issue, is that even with 20, sometimes there'd be a need for a renewal of those. And if there's a renewal and it only was to extend the trip reservation, not add trips to it, it seems like there should be a caveat in there that the submittal items would be essentially discussed as, you know, what's needed in there versus the submittal items that are in here assume, I think, a brand new application.
For those TAs that were approved in the old system and how they could apply.
Exactly. Not to waive everything, but essentially to recognize that they're unique. Like, do you need a full traffic study?
Kind of like post-decision.
Well, yeah, or something like that. And so maybe there's a model that reflects, I mean, not to waive that, but maybe there, the circumstantial issues are, yeah, the reserve, they're still reserved, they're in the system, they haven't been eroded, and all we're doing is extending them. So.
I remember one other comment we had from last month, and it was kind of a difference in the process for county-initiated DAs, because mm-hmm. your first few steps mm-hmm. could be eliminated, because it talks about bringing it to council first, yeah. seeing if they wanted to do it. If so, it goes through those other steps. Right. But if the county's initiating it, we should assume that they want to do it. And it skips those. Did you? Okay. So if you have anything else to add, but I remember that being one of our conversation points. So. Did you have any other ones, Steve, since you're...
No, I guess the interpretation is you've got the number of applicability, number two there, where it says we're adopted under separate authority. I suppose that might be your catch for county initiated as that kind of development agreement. It's not what would be considered a project development agreement or would be outside of the authority. That'd be the interpretation, I guess, I could use the argument. It still seems like it should be more clear in the code that this applies to the developer initiated project agreements and doesn't apply to county initiated development agreements.
Anything else? I'll make those notes in there for the council to consider.
And this has already been a PC.
It has been.
Hearing?
Yes, sir.
One thing I felt was a little bit lacking in this, and it's provided for directly in the RCWs, and it's sort of a bit like a conflict also within the own statute, but the purpose of DAs is to provide some greater flexibility in how projects are contemplated, and while they need to be necessarily consistent with the other development regulations, there also needs to be some recognition that you might want to try something creative in there, and so you might need to have a specific call out in the applicability portion, just citing that section of the DA statute. Let me pull it up. I'm just gathering quickly. Yeah.
Anything else?
So I think you're looking for a motion from us.
I am. I thought you guys were going to ask a question, too.
What was that?
What are the fees?
Oh.
I don't have an answer.
Okay. That was a good teaser. Yeah.
Are you trying to look at the RCW stuff?
Yeah. Just under RCW 3670B 170, that's the authorized section. You know, it allows you to change development standards.
Oh, as part of it.
As part of the agreement, including permitted uses, residential densities, intensities, building sizes. So I think you need to, I'm not telling your PA's office what to do here, but I think there needs to be some additional reference in there to add that flexibility in cases where it may be warranted.
And there's a WAC that defines that?
It's an RCW.
RCW, okay. So that RCW, is that referenced in the lower code?
Yeah, RCW 3670B 170, specifically sub 3. And I've given this a lot of thought over the year, and I think that this is a tremendous tool, and development agreements are sort of the future of land development. We need to think more creatively on how we can utilize this to get a better built environment rather than looking just at strict code-based zoning.
It's a good example, Jamie, of that in Washougal, where that was volunteered, and going back to complete streets before complete streets was even really a word, that they chose standards that went beyond the city code towards that environment. Yeah. Just probably.
So, before you make the recommendation, let me repeat back what I heard. We would like to know how DAs approved before there were specific standards, how they get extended with the new standards in place. You would like the duration instead to say, or earlier to say, unless otherwise specified. For county-initiated development agreements, you want some language to address some processes that may be skipped if this does not apply. And then a reference to RCW 3670A.170 subpart 3 that references the flexibility that development agreements can apply. Correct.
Yeah, and I think those are all correct. Now, I think in terms of the parameters around the flexibility, I think there could be a fairly narrow band on the requirements. Where the specific example was where there's an extension of reservation of existing trips versus a new authorization of trips. I mean, I think it could be narrowed to that so it doesn't look like there's preferential treatment, but rather it's an extension beyond for something already pre-negotiated that was essentially sunsetting.
So in the essence of time, I make a motion based on those recommendations that we support with the changes that we mentioned that you just previously reiterated.
I'll second that.
No discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstained? Are you okay with the word?
Thank you.
Thank you very
much.
Thank you,
Matt. Thank you.
And if you wanted to circulate that out once it's drafted, So we get all those points that Matt mentioned. We can make sure they're correct, but I'm sure we'll get them all.
I'll send it to the board.
Perfect.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Any public comment?
I guess just following up on that email that you sent to the group about the site control intersections and if measured from basic curve 50 feet back, you know, in some standard T intersection, it can cut across the lot and actually impact, you know, the driveway location the same as an uncontrolled. But that was the direction we got. You know, recent red lines was that 15 feet should be from basic curb.
Yeah, there was a, and I don't know if this is something where, how are we for the agenda next month?
I don't think we have a thing on there.
Should we add that to next month?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the only one we have is transportation improvement program that I know how Susan needs, so we'd be here to talk about the team, the CCM team. That's what you want to know. Do you know what?
I think College Drive is next month, too. The College Drive.
Yeah, because that was on, I thought that was supposed to be for this month.
They got pushed.
Okay.
They weren't ready.
Okay.
But we'll add time to this when I talk.
So we're going to put that on for next month then?
Sounds
and
like.
And is this a discussion item or is this a more technical item that needs to be worked out in
I
back room?
I think we need to do the work in advance. What it is,
yeah,
is that the definition of
discussion.
Definition of travel lane. Mm-hmm.
Is it that's right.
The extent of the road from curb to curb, or is it the parking lot when it is not striped?
I got you. Yeah.
Do you include that or not? You know, some folks say, you know, since you can drive anywhere, mm-hmm. the whole thing is driven way, so you have to be back from the face of the curb.
I see.
But the other argument is that if the standard detail shows 8 foot parking from the care, then it should be measured from that 8 foot line, which would be 70.
Which would significantly improve your sentence.
So that's the discussion here. To me, it's more of a like research and figuring out exactly what. Or maybe even, you know, maybe we can talk to transportation groups. What is, you know, what exactly should be done? You know, I'm not sure if the definitions are that clear. But what would be, you know, more appropriate way of measuring the site distance, the 15 foot path. And also look at other jurisdictions. As an example, Washington has a 10 foot path.
Right.
And it would be good to know where they measure from. I think you showed something from, was it Washington or Ashland?
Well, the definition was from Washington.
Right.
And you know, it said the traveled way, and it was a little bit, it could be interpreted either way, I think.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's a good use of your time to be discussing it rather than maybe we can do something within the next month and bring something here.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, again, I'm not sure, you know, is it going to be any different than what we're talking to? If we, you know, try to leave it until next month.
And one thing is, you know, with your standard curb and gutter, you've got the gutter itself, and just that alone, you know, it would be pretty rare that you'd ever see a car driving with its wheel on that gutter. And the city of Vancouver, when they have a section that doesn't show on-street parking, they show 2 feet clear from, you know, your standard travel, and then 2 feet clear to the face of curb.
Right.
And, you know, the difference of those 2 feet is enough that, like, on a standard intersection, you know, it can clear the lot at that point.
So we put shiny signs.
Probably local access.
28
footer. I mean, 28 to 30,
what is that? 28 or
32? Let me put it from the perspective, from transportation perspective. You have a T intersection, straight. We're not taking into account curb width. If you have parking on one side, that means that the other two directions of traffic are closest to where the T is. So where is that 12 foot measured from, or that distance measured from, when you could have people parking on the opposite side of the T or forcing the traffic towards the the other to the south side of the
if you have it on the north.
If you're on the opposite side of the center line, you're pushing traffic towards the curb where you're dealing with the cyclists at the property line. So it's not an easy answer to come out and say what the answer is, because there's a lot of moving parts.
Except that you need to figure it out, because you have to apply something, you know.
I understand.
It is not easy for us to.
I'd love to have some exhibits too to be able to kind of reference. So for those that are visual people like myself, I can see how it's gonna.
Yeah.
I mean, that's great. If we can expand,
let me get a
diagram. No, that's right. It would be helpful to have something where you could actually show this is what we're talking about. These are the dimensions.
Yes.
If cars are parked here, this is where the travel. This is where the cars are going to go. So you have a different situation on 32 foot for JV than you have on 28 foot.
So are you guys going to get together?
Yeah, I've got some ideas. I think it makes sense. And I think it's kind of a compromise between it, because I think you at an intersection you have to assume the two cars are going to pass. You should assume the travel lane is 20 feet. But the road standards really show 12 foot lane. So I think if you take a T intersection different than a cross, you take from the center line 10 foot over, that's where you measure. You can assume that two cars should be able to pass at the intersection because there's no parking
at the intersection.
The T is interesting.
Would you be willing to take you into my neighborhood and show you the T intersection that is three houses from where I live where people always park?
Well, that works against what we're saying. We're going to go with the most conservative then. Because otherwise, yeah. They're saying it should always be up, you know, we use the 12-foot lane. I'm actually going more conservative. We're probably on safety saying that it's 10 feet over, not 12 feet from right now, the road standard. So a 12-foot lane, cars parked on both sides. So the travel lane, basically, if you're going to say that, it would be 6 foot from the center line. I'm saying, no, it should be at least 10 foot from the center line. Then you measure it from there. Because you have to be able to allow two cars to pass. And if there's parking on the north side, you shift that 20-foot lane section down to the 8 foot, then the over. I think there's like a pretty good, reasonable solution here that actually functions. It's the way the road functions.
So I talked to EJOS, and EJOS is, everyone knows EJOS. Mm-hmm. EJOS has been working on design standards for quite a while, and he says he's got quite a few of these things kind of already fleshed out, and it might be a matter of coming and showing what we've got. And then picking at those things.
If it's the new detail, though, that we just that you brought up, someone brought up, then that's inconsistent. That's the problem. So I think we have to discuss that detail before it gets implemented. And those things, I guess, with DEEB, the purpose of DEEB is so that before those go public, they probably should go through the board, and some of those aren't going through the board, and we're not getting these, and then we're dealing with it later. So when these come out, if you guys have these fleshed out, we should bring them. We should kind of work through them, and maybe we can figure out some unintended consequences or how to function so to avoid conflicts in the future. Okay. So sounds like work's been done. Bring it here, and we'll go through it. And I think I don't think this is going to be that controversial once we really think about it. I think there's a solution out there already.
Just a thought. It may not be helpful, but Cascade Park, which was part of Clark County, has been annexed. And is there a standard there that works? I think that probably is fairly similar to other parts of Clark County in the way it's developed. I'm not sure if that helps or not.
Cascade Park is older and it's going to have wider roads.
Okay.
We started going on narrow road sections and something that is 20-ish.
Gotcha. Okay.
Ish. Yeah, that's about right.
So it probably doesn't help, but just trying to look for an example.
Yeah, out in Palaima where there are 40-foot wide roads from curb to curb, you have a different
style.
Yeah,
yeah.
The road is so wide.
Yeah,
it's
just
a local access.
Yeah.
Okay, with that, anything else?
Eric and Andrew.
Yeah, no.